and welcome to this episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is episode 223, where we're talking about streamlining SaaS. And today I am joined with one of our newer hosts, Benga. Benga, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. I'm great.
Yeah, we had a very interesting session today, didn't we? We were always talking all about SaaS, as always, one of our most popular topics, always backed by popular demand. We were talking about a lot of intricacies, really, and we were very fortunate to have some very good discourse going on in the chat. Spoke about a few things in the news, mainly the Capita breach, of course, where the ICO fined them $14 million, and talked a little bit about Greg Wallace and his current claims that the BBC are not responding to his SARS. Now, Benga, it's a very interesting one, I thought, but how did you find the session?
It was very educative, to be fair. Learned lots of stuff, read the comments, and I feel people really, really liked the session. But one thing that struck me is the fact that the ICO has said AI is not very okay for SAR searches. Mm. And, my honest take on this is, yes, although they've been given approval, but this needs some human review of results, definitely. It needs accuracy checks, responsible use and everything. So is AI ready? My take, absolutely yes. For initial search and discovery, AI can search multiple systems simultaneously, find relevant documents faster than humans, flag documents for review. As long as, there's this human verification loop behind the search, I think as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And we had some really interesting conversations, thanks to obviously David, who decided to unmute and share some insight into his search terms as well. I think search terms is a really interesting element of SaaS that we don't really go into, but it's the key and focal point of getting effectively the right information for the SaaS without making it as onerous on you. We've had some really interesting insights on there. We spoke a lot about retention as well, which is great because it links very easily with a SaaS. And if you want your SaaS to be easier, then I would always recommend that you get retention as airtight as you can. Now, I'm not going to give too much away because I think this is a really interesting session. So I'll let you dive straight into it and we'll see you in the next one.
Yeah. Yes, my week has been very wild. I think I've had about four separate clients, wanting to get an about SAR. And all were panicking about SARS. And I think specifically, one ex-employee was threatening legal action. Yes, so it was that serious, basically. Then aside SARS, I dealt with ROPAS a lot. Then just some, advising clients different on data protection stuff.
How about you? Yeah, I mean, We see SARS all the time on support, which I don't think is surprising. It can be one of those more like touchy areas of the law, because a lot of it's very gray in terms of the wording and some of the definitions we get, which we'll probably talk in later with stuff like the doer and the reasonable and proportionate searches.
But she gets in the way.
Not quite sure who that is. I might bob her on mute. Apologies if you are trying to speak to us. But I know that we're going to speak a little bit about that in terms of some of the doer changes as well. But before we do that, talk a little bit about what we've seen in the news, because there's a few interesting pieces I've seen in the news. The first one not being so SAR related, the second one probably being quite SAR related. Being the Capita data breach. So Capita has recently been fined $14 million for a data breach that affected over 6 million people, which is very substantial. So it was a cyber attack that exposed personal data of 6.6 million people, which was included criminal records and financial details. I believe they're a pensions company.
Pension records, yes. Actually, over 600 organizations were involved in this.
Yeah, and I think the ICO made our first vision of it from how many times it was reported to them through other parties as well, originally facing a larger fine, which the ICO tend to drop down once they've seen evidence of like mitigating factors and compliance and cooperation. I'm not really sure whether there are always factors for dropping the fine. I mean, I guess it makes sense if they weren't to at all. But a big piece of the, obviously a big piece of the news this week being the Capita stuff, which is, it's interesting. It's interesting seeing the ICO take a bit of a an occasional firmer stance. It's rare that they fine, and especially on personal data breaches recently, apart from stuff like, well, the MOD stuff, kind of, but not really. It's a bit, I don't know. I don't know if it shows a new leaf for the Information Commission. It's probably hard not to get involved with this one with how substantial the records were, but definitely something that I thought was beneficial to bring up.
Very well. Yes, I absolutely agree with you. You know, I think the original fine was about 45 million pounds, yes, which was reduced to 14 million pounds, just because Capital cooperated with the regulators, which was the ICO. Then also they think they admitted liability and made improvement post-breach. So I think ICO saw this couple of bits and said, okay, let's give them a discount. Seems to be
a fact, a little bit of a discount, maybe. Seems to be a bit of a factor in these fines, doesn't it? Is how cooperative they are and what they've done sort of post event, I suppose, which is obviously crucially important. We can't always prevent these breaches, but sometimes it's about how we act afterwards, which, you know, which is nice to see. It's nice to see that element of leniency sometimes where it's deserved. And then the second one being, again, a lot more star focused, which is with Greg Wallace, who's obviously recently been in the news in relation to the BBC. Is the, I think, is he like a master chef? Is that what he does? He does one of the cooking things. He's one of the presenters on there. He was recently trying to sue the BBC for distress and harassment following his very recent sacking, claiming that he's been making multiple subject access requests that are effectively being ignored, or they've failed to respond to these requests. Now, I think the wording of that is probably potentially very telling. I don't know what that says to you, but to me, maybe it means that they're rejecting these SARs, unknown for what reason. You know, he could be asking for something that's unreasonable. Obviously, there's only so much that we know. But I do know that he is trying to push the BBC for basically non-compliance with data protection law as well in his lawsuit. But, you know, is it just an attempt to fan the flames?
Yeah, so I think the background is that Wallace gets sacked from MasterChef over misconduct allegations, then which he doesn't really agree with necessarily. Then March 2025, he, you know, sends us to BBC and BBC Studios and asks for 21 years of records. He's been with them for 21 years. So he's asking for 21 full years of records, everything including about his work, contract, conduct. And BBC allegedly didn't respond. So that was the background story of it.
Okay.
So the question is, he asked for 21 years of records. BBC probably has thousands, millions of emails about him, hundreds of contracts, meeting notes, you know, recorded shows, correspondences with several agents. Would they really ask, you know, look for that 21 years of these records?
You know? Well, can they run it? And it brings into the point that we were sort of leaning on to sort of very earlier, Benger, in relation to the reasonable and proportional search that is now, obviously, initially ICO guidance, now is written within the Doer. You know, is that a reasonable and proportionate search? You know, probably quite a heavy element of BAU, I imagine. You know, with being an ex-employee of the BBC, probably a lot of elements around meetings that he's probably going to be carrying out, or, you know, when he's doing the actual recordings for the show, all the elements relating to that. Obviously, I'm sure there's going to be probably some juicy elements in relation to his sacking, which is of course what he wants, but how effectively do you think an organization has to sit in the lines of what is reasonable and proportionate? Because it's not very well defined, is it? You know, it's very clearly, very briefly defined.
It's actually very vague. That's a word. Very vague. Just reasonable and proportionate. So in this instance, less than 24-year records. So what is indeed reasonable? What is proportionate when it comes to, for example, this type of search?
Well, what do you think affects it? I mean, I think there's loads of things that affects it. You know, how many systems am I searching for? How many systems am I searching through? How long has the person been around? What is the actual relationship between me and this individual? Obviously, relationship is really key with SARs. Obviously, if they're making a SAR, there probably is some kind of direct relationship at some point or another. Maybe not, but in the common cases, you'll find that they are, you know, tenant to the housing association, you've got employee to a business. In terms of the most common ones that we see, obviously sometimes students in schools or parents of students in schools. So there's always a direct relationship. So there's always bound to be quite a lot of data pertaining to them, or quite a significant amount of data pertaining to them. And I think the relationship matters because, yeah, I mean, Cecilia's right. It's subjective. And they would have to assess probably based on what they would in their own mind, but they're not very good at pushing that forward in terms of the factors that I think influence what makes it. And I think the reason it's vague is to give businesses the opportunity to use it as they see fit.
Very well. You know something, I think the point is, you know, allegedly BBC never responded to the SAR. You know, that was made it very obvious. So assuming they responded, you know, and asked for more clarifications, you know, what does he want? What system should we search? And probably tells him we won't be searching backdrops, you know, pre-2010 systems and everything. I think that might have probably helped the case a whole lot better than not responding at all.
Yeah, well, obviously it's alleged at the moment. So in terms of whether they have or they haven't, obviously ignoring them is not good. I think I seen a case the other day. I think which was in September, of someone in like a care home. I think it was a business owner in Bridlington who was fined quite a small fine for just ignoring requests, but also concealing and deleting data, which is obviously again another bigger issue. But I think sometimes there is this almost like need or sometimes a little bit of a desire for people to want to ignore these requests because of the nature in which of how they come across and how they come up, and that feels quite often an onerous to me. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that in terms of dealing with particular or maybe contentious data subjects. Do you feel like that changes in how people view them making a SAR, as if they kind of take it as like a tongue-in-cheek almost?
Absolutely, yes, I do. I do think along the lines, you know. And for me, I think BBC probably had two options or asked two options. One, they should probably acknowledge and clarify the SAR. Then secondly, use the reasonable search, you know. But then allegedly they never did any of this, and that's complicated the matters the most. And third options, if they could probably use the exemptions and apply it very carefully, legal professional privilege, ongoing legal proceedings, you know, third party data and everything, and explaining why they're doing these things. I think it might have reduced the level of data. But allegedly, again, they never did any of these and it made the matter worse.
Well, yes. Lawrence has put something really interesting in the chat, but effectively around in terms of what you search. And I think you're right in terms of what we're getting in the scope of these. And I think, oh, David, I see you with your hand up. You want to feel free to jump in? I think you're on mute at the moment, David.
I am. That's better. Yeah, sorry about that. And apologies to Lawrence, because I think he made some great points and you were just about to read them out. So you probably should have finished that first. But
no worries.
I was going to say, I think this could be quite groundbreaking in terms of if the case is about the BBC's non-respondence, then I agree with you guys. Absolutely. There isn't a defence to not responding. Yeah. So, but that is different to exactly what you're saying, what they respond with. His request. I mean, there are so many things you could begin to challenge it with and reduce it down. And I think the proportionate piece, you know, if they come close to anything like 21 years, a lot of what I've come across from a business point would begin to fall flat. You know, if we've got case law that went, no, it worked for you, we'd have to really seriously consider it. You know, we do a lot of employee-based SARs, and I have never yet, well, apart from somebody who was with us for less than a year, searched for the period of their employment. Never yet. Maybe over contract documents, that kind of, you know, there is that. But in terms of the type of things that I understand Greg Wallace is looking for around communications, conversations, and emails, we're very targeted, few keywords, and for a period of time that's critical. And there is the piece generally I think we wouldn't, you know, have across 21 years. Our complaints don't tend to run for that duration. And here there is the piece, I suppose, that the BBC have suggested that there are some historical allegations that were overlooked, so maybe could go after that. I'm also thinking, if the BBC have got 21 years worth of emails, what's the retention policy?
Well,
like, that's quite an interesting one as well. But
yeah, it's definitely
I think it's one we need to watch. Like I say, I'm hoping it from a purely personal, falls flat on the fact that it's a case about the BBC and non-respondents. And absolutely, you know, we respond to absolutely everything. We explain, and we will explain why we aren't responding if we believe it's vexatious or whatever else, you know.
Yeah.
However, we respond to absolutely everything. And we, you know, no matter how tenuously we believe it might be a SAR, you know, if somebody says, you know,
sorry, may I ask, even business as usual, you know, data that's considered BAU, do you respond to that too?
It depends what you mean by do you consider BAU. So,
you know, for example, if you know, let's give Wallace, you know, BBC's emails, tens of thousands of millions. So are you trying to say you would get all the data that's his name present on the emails too? Everything.
So we would come up with a structure that we would look at who Wallace had engaged with and who could be speaking about him on the authority of the organisation. So we would take out, and I think the new ICO guidance supports this piece anymore, but we've done it for a while. I'm sure it's one of the reasons why they've gone there. But we'd essentially take out what could be considered just be discussion by two junior employees, not on behalf of the business. It's just tittle tattle or whatever else. We don't even consider looking there. We look at people who would be, or we believe are, processing data of the individual that have got a right to process it on behalf of the organization. And we tend to search around there. And it's ours are always, in fact, not that different from Greg's. A lot of mine are this kind of, not this kind, but employment type complaints where there is a number of people involved. And we look, and sometimes they will say, I want you to search everyone. We've never done that. We can't do that.
They can still ask for it, I suppose.
They can ask for it. We will always explain. And, you know, on a couple of occasions, we've been asked to explain ourselves. We've explained ourselves. And, yeah, it's gone no further. You know, so far, our responses have held.
So far, so good. Yeah. I mean, I think you raised such an important part about the way in which you search for stuff. And I really resonate with that because, you know, when first and foremost, thank you very much for speaking on that. It was very interesting. Seen a few things in the comments that probably are going to iterate into my point, hopefully. But the really key thing, as you mentioned with search terms, is looking at the actual relevance and the scope of what they're wanting and where we're probably going to find it. Instead of running let's just run everything and see if so-and-so from on the help desk is also talking about this complaint, which they're probably not. And if they are, is that tonally the scope and the need for the request? Possibly not. I mean, likely in the nature of, as you mentioned, employer X, employee SARS, a lot of the discussion is going to be around key members of the team, of the business, people like HR, your directors, or whoever's investigating the complaint. Not always, first and foremost, that doesn't always mean it's going to be disclosed, but there's also a real telling element of, you know, people, I think, sometimes take this approach where, you know, they're asking for so much because I think it's a lot of data. I'm going to intentionally say, or not intentionally, but because I'm kind of already annoyed, I'm going to push back a little bit and say, you know, you're asking for too much, instead of really looking at the heart of the SAR and what they're asking for and taking a little bit more of the approach of let's look at the elements of this that matters instead of wholly trying to appease their request or to reject it based on probably not very knowledgeable wording from the individuals, or maybe not a sense of knowing, or maybe not knowing what they want, but also trying to get whatever they can. There's always the element of that where people will chance as much as they can because that's what they want, and it's up to the organization to set the boundaries for that.
Very well, I agree with you completely. So let's be practical and realistic. You know, I know, you know, in your course of work, you know, seeing stuff like people asking for all their data, and you send them probably another email explaining for clarifications, and they still come back with the same, all their data. And to be fair on them, under the law, under the GDPR, they entitle you to this right of access to permission. So what do you really do, you know, when someone comes with the all of my data, regardless? What do you do?
Obviously, the first thing you do is you respond and you acknowledge it, and you try and, if you feel like you need to, you try and clarify the scope. They're well within their rights to say that they don't want to, and that's okay. You know, that's fine. Yeah. But what you then need to understand this again, and my importance that I'll always stress is the heart and nature of the scope. I think one of the key things that I found when we did our in-person event with SARS quite a while ago now, there's a real big focus from the people in that group of looking at the actual cause of this SAR. Why has this SAR arose? Are we getting them all in relation to a particular team? Are they all centered around a particular thing, grievances, complaints? Maybe it's in relation to tap issues or repair issues. You know, there's always a cause for a SAR. People will not just make a SAR. And yep. I think it's understanding that. And then from there, building in stringent search terms and filtering properly and searching effectively. And one, having appropriate records disposal, because people like, oh, you know, this SAR's shown hundreds of thousands of documents. Should you still be holding those 100,000 documents? You know, why have you got emails from 12 years ago? Like, why are those still hanging around? And then when it comes around to the SAR, they feel like they're kicking themselves. But, you know, if you're making sure that you're tight with your retention periods, and of course, things do need to be held for longer. But if you feel like you're a little bit more tighter in on those, then, you know, it should be an easier process. But I feel like there's an element of people maybe making life a little bit harder for themselves than it needs to be.
then these days, I've seen quite a lot in my practice. In principle, people or data subjects now resort to ChatGPT to request for all manner of things. You know, the use of AI is impacted, I would say, negatively. Just go and type on ChatGPT and, you know, ask all manner of requests.
Which is why we're getting so many SARs, right? I had to hazard a guess, from all my customers that I speak to, they're talking about this massive influx in SARs, and they're all very specific in nature.
They all look alike.
Yeah, they all look the exact same. And I was speaking to Alex, our account manager at Data Protection People, and I'm sure any of our customers will know Alex. And she was talking about how now social housing are basically getting all of the same, like literally basically copy and pasted the exact same letter. I think it was in relation to CCTV disclosure, which they found was from like a social media person who was effectively like saying, oh, this is what you need to do to get this from the landlord. And I think maybe we spoke about this not that long ago, but we spoke about people saying that if you're making more SARs, you become a priority for like repairs and stuff like that. And people like almost spinning a narrative so people are more inclined to make these SARs. Which I think is really interesting. But obviously, with the rise of AI, it's a lot easier for people to exercise their rights, which if they're in, you know, they're entitled to. So, you know, fair play, good on them. But an interesting thing that I heard, and this might not be true because I did hear it from a customer. I'm not sure if anyone can corroborate, but the ICO had their big event the other day, didn't they? I think it was either Tuesday, I think, or Wednesday. And they apparently gave a talk on AI and SARS and approved that they're comfortable with the use of AI tools for searching and undertaking searches for SARS. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, Benga, in terms of using AI on AI solutions on searching for SARS, maybe even redactions in some elements as well. You know, do you have a particular view on that?
Well, to be fair, my position is as long as the AI tool does what you are expected of it to do, then no problem at all. As long as it can search very, very deeply and locate all this data belonging to this data subject, why not? Of course, it's allowed. Anything to help and streamline your work process or your work schedule is definitely, definitely welcome.
But it's allowed to an extent, though, isn't it? And the wording of the ICO, and from what I've heard, again, if you didn't hear the ICO saying this, tell me that that I'm talking rubbish. Oh, thank you, Mira. Talking about that's probably going on to my point in terms of the results being checked. Yes. You know, please do not treat AI as this solution completely to all of your SARs. and from the word in the ICO saying, oh, we just approve the use of it. I mean, no, that's technically not how that works. Yes, you can approve it as an organization based on very stringent risk assessments and work relation to it and making sure, you know, we can't remove that human touch. Because, yeah. I mean, from what I've seen, I've seen people use AI for SARs. And some of the stuff that has been left out of scope, some of the stuff that was in scope, or some of the random stuff it's decided to redact or remove completely in some cases is just crazy to me. But this is only happening and they're only receiving pushback because they're not checking the SARs. You know, Tina, obviously our SAR manager, makes a great point that sometimes the redactions are awful and they're just sending them out, but it can work and it can be a very, very effective tool.
As long as there's a human verification loop behind, you know,
yeah,
to verify and check and cross-check, definitely, of course, it's allowed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, obviously, subject to doing the standard stuff with in terms of your DPIAs and making sure that people are aware of the use of AI. But yeah, that's what I heard from the session, which was interesting. I also heard our podcast got a shout out on the ICO's event as well, which is
amazing.
Which is quite cool. Yeah, though I'm sure you know, Phil, Katarina, they'll probably hear that, being very glad, who obviously aren't here today. But no, that was very nice. But I just think that's an interesting point. Obviously AI is and always will be very prevalent now, but there's people sit in two camps. It's either, oh, we'll use it for everything, or, you know, let's steer away from this. But if you exercise caution, it can be a very effective tool in streamlining that process. But there's an element of, you know, how far are we going?
Yes. So, but before we come to the end, can we talk about, you know, the common SAR challenges, you know, that we face? How about that?
Yeah.
Do we have time?
I think we got time. You know, I don't mind if it stretches over a little bit. I mean, I think a big one occasionally is the use of systems, and I feel like sometimes I say this till I'm a little bit blue in the face, but why as a business are we using so many systems for so many similar means? Basically, you know, we're using like three or four systems that effectively are doing the same thing. You know, are you just making your life harder for yourself? I understand there's an element of legacy information that will probably sit on these systems. And I think that's what I found in the main, is that you've got a lot of these systems that are legacy systems that will hold some legacy data. But there's got to be a time where we move away from that and we look into commissioning into a newer system that's holding,
yes,
you know, a lot of bulk. But yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, to complement what you've said, the reality is most organizations never get a SAR until they get a SAR. You know, at one point, there are no SAR coming, but whenever you think about it deeply, it is that very moment or that very week that a SAR will pop in. So this is what I advise people, you know, do a SAR drill, more like a fire drill, you know, probably once a year. You know, someone within your team submits a fixed SAR. See how long it takes you to find that particular data or stuff you're looking for. See what the systems, you know, that you need to watch out for, you need to search very well, identify the gaps and fix them. I think that will prepare you for, you know, any potential SAR panic that may ever come.
Yeah, I think sometimes potentially elements of staff knowledge and training plays a part into this. Depends on how much of an involvement they actually have in the SAR process. But I know in particular a lot of employees can get quite tense when it comes around to a SAR being run. You know, first and foremost, understand as an employee that in certain circumstances, not all, you know, pending exemptions and reductions and the like,
yeah,
some of the information that is said about other people is out there. Should that be tied back to you in any sense? No, because if it does, then it should be exempt. But people need to understand what is in scope of a SAR and what if I am an employee, if I make a SAR, what I'm reasonably going to get. You know, I think people are treating SAR sometimes as this sort of like secret little discovery tool where you can get whatever you want, and you know it doesn't work like that. And I think sometimes, obviously, data subjects won't understand that, but it's our role as, you know, privacy practitioners to be able to explain that to them. And I think I was literally having this conversation maybe about a couple of minutes ago before the session. It's always important when we receive a SAR. I think a SAR, especially sometimes that you know is going to turn up a lot of things that we're withholding, we're not providing, is making that clear from the main, because that can change the nature of these requests. You know, why would we effectively poke the bear of a, you know, a tenant who's typically upset and complains a lot when we've received a SAR and we know we're probably not going to provide what they're looking for? You know, why are we not communicating that more effectively instead of probably giving them some documents with some roundabout data on there? And I think communications in all part of this, these stages of a SAR, is really, really important and crucial. You know, if I made a SAR and I heard from the off that, you know, a lot of the stuff I'm asking for is probably not going to be in scope, when I receive the SAR, where I've explained what's probably going to be in scope, you know,
yeah,
I'm if that's not been communicated prior, I'm going to be very upset. And maybe if it had been communicated prior, you've probably alleviated a little bit of that tension, or maybe just stopped the side dead out, which obviously isn't always the route that we want. But people, I think, need to understand a little bit more from the offset what's probably looking like that they're going to receive.
Very well. Well said. So another challenge that I get often is many people find it difficult to track the time frame.
Mm.
You know, there's this Excel spreadsheet disaster that comes. So clients come to me and, track SaaS in Excel and stuff. Show me that when I see the spreadsheet, there are no deadline calculations, no status tracking, no assignment of responsibility, probably just a list of names and dates, that's all. So I think my fix would be, you know, minimum viable SAR tracker needs the dates that was received, of course.
Mm.
Needs the, you know, 30-day deadline calculated, automatically calculated, the date the ID was verified, if clock stops or not, the date clarification receives, if the clock stops to you, the new deadline after the clock stops. Then, of course, should contain the status, you know, received, in progress, responsive, then assigned to the name of the person that which was assigned to, then notes and issues. Many people don't really take, you know, time to do all those things. That's why they get caught up in the date. Or when did we send a start? Is in progress and stuff like that. So that's another big challenge that should be looked at.
Yeah, I mean, it sometimes can fall down to just all sort of register holding, I suppose, which can be an issue. I do appreciate that. Hopefully that shouldn't be the case. You know, you shouldn't be getting to the deadline of a SAR and thinking, oh, actually, what's the date on that again? You know, I'm hoping that registers are maintained enough for information, right? You know, if not, and if it's something that you feel like you're struggling with, compliance management systems are a really good workaround to that. You know, having something that's built in, like our very own DataWise, sorry to plug, but things like OneTrust, obviously there's tons of solutions out there, but it's important to have somewhere to centralize it and something that is key to go to and can keep you basically onerous for you.
Trapped.
Yeah, exactly. It's the overarching key. Benga, I don't know if you have any closing remarks, because I appreciate that it's getting the end to the half an hour again. You know, I know.
Oh, really?
I know how quickly these tend to fly. So if you've got any closing remarks, we can cover that before the end of the session.
I think we've covered a lot of things. You know, real fund spend cases, the capital, the wallets as a BBC. Then we've covered some challenges too, you know, involving SaaS. So my key probably takeaway would be preparation beats panic. That's the first thing. If possible, you should do a SAR drill before you need to in your company, in your organizations. You know, have your systems ready, train your teams, which is very, very important. Then SAR gives you some powers. So use your new powers under the DORA Act. For example, clock stopping should be your best friend. You know, ask for clarifications. Let the clock stop before you go ahead. More importantly, the reasonable search, which is a very big game changer. And never, never be afraid to ask for clarifications when you're confused on what's searching. Mm. I'll probably end with submit as a request, you know, a data, you know, eye volumes tells you something, fix the problem, then don't just treat it as a symptom. You know, there are really problems until they come. So that's all basically.
Yeah, no, thank you, Benga. Very, very insightful words. I appreciate that. I'll leave you probably two things. One, you know, check retention is working as it should in the business if you want your searches to be a little bit easier, which I'm sure everybody does. And secondly, you know, have a look at those search terms if it's something that you feel like you're struggling with. Obviously, we've had some really, really great insight from everybody in the chat. You know, thank you very much, David, for speaking up as well. That was great. And obviously, it's something that we can all collectively come together as a community and discuss about, which is fantastic. But that's everything for this session today. We really hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you next week. I'm not sure what the one next week actually is. Probably GDPR news. If not, it might be another SaaS session, because there's a lot more to unpack when it comes to these side things. But
I think we deserve like a second session, you know, part two of SaaS.
I think so. But thank you very much, guys, and we'll hopefully see you in the next one.
Thank you.
Ta-ra.
Thanks, everyone.